Okay, happy Friday, everyone. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:36 p.m. on Friday, February 27th, 2026. Present today are Representatives Allard, Stapp, Moore, Bynum, Hannon, Galvin, Jimmy, and two of the three co-chairs, co-chair Schragi and myself, co-chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, committee assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier, and I'm going to just have a quick conversation. Mr. LIO moderator, your name is?
Doug Bridges.
Doug Bridges. I know he's a jazz musician. And if 2 months from now someone types that into the record, that's fine. Okay, before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, the Department of Family and Community Services will present on its FY27 budget overview. Then they will take a closer look at the Office of Children's Services budget and provide responses to their legislative audit. Following their presentation will be invited testimony by Les Guerra, former Alaska State Representative, joined by Amanda Mativier of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, or something darn close to that. Let me go off script here and tell you why we're doing that. So in the media, you've probably all seen particular interest in OCS. We had a good meeting, productive meeting, I thought, in subcommittee yesterday. So I chair this subcommittee. There could be some budget asks in our closeout next week. That's true of every subcommittee closeout. But it's topical, and I wanted you to be aware of those issues. After Representative Guerra and Ms. Mativier speak, we're going to offer the department a chance to respond to their comments. It's a little bit unusual, but this is what we're doing today. So if you've always wanted to ask specific questions about OCS, this is a great opportunity. The slide deck provided to the committee contains both the FY27 budget overview and the OCS presentation. Slides 1 through 15 are the budget overview. When we complete slide 15, we'll pause for questions before we move on to slide 16 to 34. With us today from the department to present on its FY27 budget overview is Tracy Dompling, acting commissioner, and Marion Sweet, assistant commissioner, who seems to know everything about the department. Available for questions in the room at the appropriate time, this will be sort of later in the presentation, are Kim Gui, Director of the Office of Children's Services, Matt Davidson, Director for Division of Juvenile Justice. Available online for questions for the FY27 budget overview is Dr. Kern McGinley, Director for the Alaska Pioneer Homes, and Michaela Vire, hope I got that right, Deputy Director for the Coordinated Health and Complex Care Unit. Acting Commissioner Dompling and Assistant Commissioner Sweet, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tracy Dompling, and I'm the Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. I've been in this position since I believe it was January 3rd, after previously Commissioner Koval went to work for the federal administration. So I may be new to this position. I am not new to the department. I have worked either when it was a standalone department, as it currently is, or when we were joined with Department of Health for about 27 years. I've also worked for 2 years at the Department of Health as the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. When I was previously with this department, I was also the director for the Division of Juvenile Justice. So, again, maybe new to this role, but I'm certainly happy to be back in the department, and a lot of the operations of our various divisions are not new to me. So today I'm going to pass it over to Marion Sweet, who's going to go through our budget slides, and as Chair said, then we'll have Director Gui come up and talk about the audit for Office of Children's Services.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Marion Sweet. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services, and I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to share with you our fiscal year 27 proposed governor's budget. The Department of Family and Community Services has a total overall budget of $511.2 million. This is in support of four direct service divisions, the Alaska Pioneer Homes, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, the Office of Children's Services, and the Division of Juvenile Justice, as well as our Commissioner's Office and Departmental Support Services. Our total overall positions is 1,846. Our proposed budget is an increase of 0.2% over our fiscal year 26 management plan. This appears low, and it is because we analyzed all of our restricted revenue sources to determine if we had any excess authority and determined that without any reductions of programs or services, we did have authority that we were unable to expend because we didn't have a mechanism to collect on. Each of our divisions will have an overall summary slide, such as this one, where I'll briefly go over the overall budget and talk to the individual fund sources. And then there are two additional slides, one where we will go over our 26 budget items, and the final slide will be our 27 budget request.
Slide three.
We wanted to share with you our position vacancy and turnover rate over the last several years. This is a point in time. It was July through the end of December, and this does include data that shows all of the department's positions, not just our direct or frontline positions. And I do want to note that, you know, in an era of telework, direct service agencies such as ours do struggle with recruitment and retention. We can't offer remote work. Our staff are in our facilities or out in the field providing direct care for Alaskans. And this work is demanding. It's both physically and mentally straining, and we recognize this. As a department, we are taking measures to help with the culture and the environment within our department so that we can help support and retain our staff. Some of the things that the departments are doing or the divisions are doing, DJJ maintains a employee-led resilience committee. API has an employee engagement committee as well as a critical incident stress management team. Our Pioneer Homes focus in each of our homes on workforce well-being, and OCS has a wellness and resiliency officer. And additionally, all of our divisions support our staff through training opportunities.
Okay. Slide four.
Slide four is our first division is Departmental Support Services. With a total of 90 full-time positions, Departmental Support Services provides quality administrative support to meet the department's mission. We have a total budget of $42.3 million. Departmental Support Services uses a direct and an allocated chargeback model for a large amount of the services that we provide the department. These are collected as interagency receipts. Additionally, we have Mental Health Trust Authority and our Coordinated Health and Complex Care Unit, and these are what make up the funding in the other category. Coordinated Health and Complex Care also has the Designated Evaluation and Treatment and Designated Evaluation and Stabilization grant programs, as well as the Disproportionate Share Hospital Program. Funding in here is General Fund Mental Health. And the match is, well, the General Fund Mental Health is in support of the match for Medicaid claims for the DISH program through an RSA with the Department of Health. All remaining expenditures within Departmental Support Services are allocated through our Public Assistance Cost Allocation Plan.
And Assistant Commissioner, remind us what the DISH is.
DISH is Disproportionate Share Hospital Funding, and it helps support hospitals in the state for uncompensated care.
Please continue.
Thank you. Here on slide five, you'll see our fiscal year 26 items, all of which were technical in nature. We moved some interagency authority from the Office of Children's Services. This excess authority was residual from when we actually provided the child care benefits through the Office of Children's Services, and then we billed Division of Public Assistance for those. That services has then been transferred over to DPA directly, and so we had this authority to be able to transfer. The other items are Mental Health Trust Authority funding to fund positions within our Coordinated Health and Complex Care team. We received a $750,000 pilot program funding of UGF to help support small group placements for complex individuals within our coordinated health and complex care team. We have funding from the Mental Health Trust Authority to cover the match for our Title 47 coordinator, and then we also transferred some positions within the department to help support the talent acquisition team so that we can do more efficient and candidate-centric hires.
Okay, slide six.
On slide six, our fiscal year 27 budget request, a new budget item, and you'll see this in a couple of our components, is for the information technology classification study. This is an increment in interagency receipts, as our IT staff do direct charge out through interagency receipts to our divisions, so we receive $452,000 for that. In addition, we worked with the Department of Health and identified a grant program that they had specific grantees whose services aligned with the activities of our department. And so $475,000, $474.3 of General Fund Mental Health was transferred from the Department of Health to our agency so we can maintain those grant programs. As you are aware, all departments are receiving back the accounts payable and accounts travel from the Department of Administration. This is a net zero, as we already housed the money to pay for those services. And then the remaining items, next two items are technical. It's the reestablishment of the Mental Health Trust Authority funding that I spoke to on the slide before, as well as the $750 for the pilot program for complex individuals. And then the final item, also technical, is the reduction of federal authority that we have within DSS, Departmental Support Services, that we don't have a way to claim for. And again, no services were reduced.
Slide seven.
In slide seven, we have our Alaska Pioneer Homes. We have six Pioneer Homes across the state providing elder Alaskans a home and community celebrating life through its final breath. They have 427 full-time positions supporting a total capacity of 506 residents with a total budget in fiscal year 27 of $118 million.
Okay.
The Alaska Pioneer Homes' largest source of funding is in the in the other category, made up of interagency receipts, mostly as collections from Medicaid, as well as from the payment assistance program within the division. Additionally, we have an RSA with the Division of Juvenile Justice, as the Pioneer Homes provides them their pharmacy services. Statutory designated program receipt authority also falls into the other category, and within the Pioneer Homes is where we collect our pharmacy programs outside of the DJJ revenue. The majority of our UGF funding is in the payment assistance program and helps support care of the elders that we have within our six homes, with a small remaining balance used to help support the cost of operations. And additionally, because the Palmer Pioneer Homes veteran status, we are able to claim funding from the Veterans Administration, which makes up the federal receipt authority.
All right, slide eight.
Thank you. Our one item for the Pioneer Homes in 26 was to remove the SDPR authority from the numbers section and move it into the language section. Our original request was done because the subsequent years, two years preceding this, we had asked for supplementals and base budget increases in SDPR due to the increasing collections that we were seeing in SDPR, and because they exceeded our authority, we were not able to expend those monies. So by moving it into the language, we were able to have a little bit more flexibility.
All right. Slide nine.
On slide nine, you'll see our 27 budget items. Here we have a receipt authority reduction in the amount of $480,000 in federal receipts. Our federal receipts are limited to the funding that we get from the Veterans Administration. However, this reduction does not impact our ability to collect for our veteran elders in our home. And then we did have conversations and decided that it would be a more appropriate classification in the language section if we change that language we had submitted the previous year to $3 million in SDPR and an estimated to be category rather than a not to exceed.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. This is sort of a process question because when you were, through the chair to Ms. Sweet, when you were describing that the Pioneer Veterans Home can get reimbursed from VA for the veterans, does that imply that in other locations we can't get reimbursed for them, but we can for their pharmacy services or others? Or,
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, because the designation of the Palmer home being a veterans home, that is the only home where we are allowed to claim from the Veterans Administration. However, we are having conversations with them now to see if there is any chance that we can expand the program for the veterans we have in other homes. But we are still just in the early conversations with them at this point.
Follow up.
Representative Hannon for AC Suite.
What is the percentage of veterans that are in the Palmer home, then? Do we reserve it 100% for veterans so that we can get reimbursement?
Commissioner.
For the record, Tracy Dompling. We can get those numbers. What the Veterans Administration wants us to be at in that home is that 75% capacity should be veterans. And we are slowly working up to that. I believe we were in the 40s. Again, we can get that information to you. So we're a bit off from the 75%, but we are working towards that. It's about turnover, and so we're not going to kick anybody out of the home so that we can, you know, get our veterans population up to the 75%. It's just that gradual piece. When a bed becomes available, the veterans usually are offered that that bed first.
Okay. One follow-up,
just trying to understand it. Veterans who are already somewhere else in our system where we're not able to collect from VA, so let's say they're at the Sitka home and would transfer them to Palmer, so VA will now pay for it, but then would end up with a bed in Sitka open for someone else. Are we trying to move veterans who are already somewhere else in our system into the Palmer home, or we're just waiting and it's new clients coming in?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we only if the individuals in the other homes want to move to Palmer. And that's when they would be afforded that opportunity if they wanted to move.
Okay, please continue.
All right, thank you. On to slide 10, we have our Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Alaska Psychiatric Institute has 5 units with a total of 80 licensed beds, 60 for civil, 10 for youth, and 10 for our forensic patients. In addition to the 80 licensed beds within the API walls, we are have expanded our service capacity by partnering with the Department of Corrections and implemented the jail-based restoration program. API has a total of 321 full-time positions, providing compassionate health care to support Alaskans living their best lives. And the governor's proposed budget for 27 is $66.9 million.
AC Suite, on this division, important division, of course, there were requests for funds in FY26 that were not delivered. I think the number $4 million comes to mind. Do you or the commissioner recall major items like that where you made an FY26 request and didn't receive it from this building?
Through to the chair, I do have those, and those will be on our next slide. Unless you want me to?
Okay. Nope, let's just go.
Okay. Just really quick. Let me go back one. Sorry. We have 2 funding sources within the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Our UGF is general fund and general fund mental health, and then the other funding is in the other category, and it is made up of interagency receipts as well as STPR. So interagency is collected from Medicaid as well as the disproportionate share hospital program, and our STPR is where we collect private pay and private insurance.
Okay. So, please continue.
In fiscal year 26, and I do apologize to the committee, there is one item that is left off the slide, but I will be speaking to it. We had asked for a funding increase in the amount of $4.4 million. We did receive the 2.2 that you see on the screen. I do want to thank the committee and the legislature for granting that funding authority to the hospital. As you recall, last year I did mention that we were working with our team, and we have hired a contractor to help evaluate our revenue streams and our billing processes. And we have seen that for fiscal year 26, we are estimated to collect an additional five over what we did last year. So the funding that we did receive from the legislature of 2.2, coupled with the increases in revenue, has kept us in the black. And so I wanted to thank you very much for that. The other item that was not on this screen is that we had requested additional $200,000 in general fund mental health funding to help support increasing our program, the SHARP program within the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. We had been running this program for 3 years, and we were coming up on the term of that 3-year grant funding from the Mental Health Trust, and wanted to be able to continue the program and expand it by offering that funding to new psychiatrists within the facility. That funding was not awarded, and we did not expand that program. We still have the remaining three that were part of the original program.
I want to be real clear about this. So you did not get $4.4 million.
We did not.
But that money you found from other sources for FY27, roughly accurate?
To the chair, we did not get the $4.4 million. We got the $2.2, and we have increased revenues to help support operations.
All right. And you did not get the $200,000 SHARP fund?
Correct.
And are you asking for that again?
We did not put forward that again at this time, but we are considering how we are going to try to fund that with the increases in the revenues that we get. So we are currently analyzing our operations to see if we have the ability internally to be able to do that.
Okay. So in the event that it doesn't come up later in the slide deck, was there a second number in that a larger number that was not appropriated to you from the legislature?
To the chair, only the half that we asked for, the 4.4 and the 200,000, is what we didn't get in 26.
Was it necessary to use, and I haven't checked this, so this is, I'm literally asking, it's not a gotcha, but in order to cover the need for API that you identified as that $4.4 million appropriation, did you use OCS dollars that were unobligated because they were vacancies and use them to fund your program? Or are you doing that now? So it's an FY26 question.
To the chair, no, we have not transferred any authority from any of our divisions to support API or any other divisions for this fiscal year.
Okay.
So we have not used any OCS or any other division's funds to support the activities of any of our other divisions.
Okay. Because I recall, and I don't want to get, I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble, but I recall someone at Ledge Finance telling me that because of the lack of appropriations, because the appropriations you didn't receive, you had to find resources elsewhere. And I'm sure it's this department, but you're reporting that, no, you stayed within your structure as we gave it to you.
To the chair, in this current fiscal year, we have not utilized transfer authority. However, last fiscal year we did, and we supplied a report to the legislature on those transfers. We did transfer funding to help support shortfalls in the Division of Juvenile Justice and API last year.
All right. Now we're on to something. Mm-hmm. And those were because of shortfalls? Again, a failure to appropriate? In FY25?
To the chair, they were transferred into the Division of Juvenile Justice because of shortfalls in expenditures due to operational costs.
Okay.
API was we were lacking revenue collections last year.
All right. And was the source of payment for those shortfalls from OCS in FY25?
To the chair, it was a combination. There was funding available within departmental support services, and OCS also had additional funding authority that we used to contribute for that shortfall.
Okay. All right. I know Representative Stepp is in the queue. I believe Representative Hannon is. Representative Stepp.
Thank you, Coach Justin, to the chair, to Assistant Commissioner Sweet. Always a pleasure to see you here, and congratulations on your acting appointment, acting commissioner. So just to kind of finish up, Coach Justin's kind of question just for the public. So you have a the legislature gives you, I think it's $10 million cross-appropriation authority, just like we do the Department of Health. And just to be clear, you have not utilized any of that authority for FY26. Is that correct, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, that is correct.
Mr. Co-chair. So when we talk about in previous years, you are unique, and the Department of Health is unique because unlike appropriations where you can just transfer within allocations, you are giving special authority by the legislature to actually move funds from RDU component to RDU component for the purpose of funding things at your discretion. Is that true through the chair?
AC Sweet.
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, we do have that unique authority, and I want to thank the legislature for allowing us to have that. I think that you recognize that we are in a unique situation because we have a hospital and an Alaska, you know, the Pioneer Homes, as well as our other divisions. We specifically those that have to bill in order to be able to spend if we have clients that are coming in that don't have Medicaid and we aren't able to get, you know, with the DSH funding that has been going down. You granting us that has allowed us to be able to continue operations and not have anything be at a detriment to the clients that we serve. So thank you.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Cooper.
Follow up. Rep. Stepp yep. for AC Suite.
Thank you. Could you address to the chair to Director Susie, AC Suite. The pilot we did in API, how's that going? And did you use any of that funds to cover this deficit to the chair?
Ms. Sweet.
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, the pilot program was the expansion of the jail-based restoration and the outpatient restoration program. And actually, the program is running incredibly well. We have expanded the jail-based program even beyond what the original terms were because we are now serving I'm speaking DFCS terms. We have expanded to those that are at Highland Correctional Center as well. We had started with Anchorage and have now expanded. So that program is working incredibly well. Thank you.
And just a quick clarification.
Clarification from Rep. Stepp for AC Suite.
Yep, thank you. Through the chair to AC Suite. So second part of the question was, did you use any of the money we allocated for the pilot program to cover this through the chair?
AC Suite. And this is what?
This item on the shortfall in the structural deficit for API through lack of received authority. Sure.
AC Suite.
through the chair to Representative Stepp. No. I mean, the funding that we received was for positions that were providing those services in the outpatient program as well as going actually to the facilities to provide the services there.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Sweet, if we could go back to slide 10 and just give me a little more detail on the growth in the other category from FY25 to FY26 management plan of the $17 million in growth in that category.
Ms. Sweet, growth at API is the question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the funding that we get inside of the other category is that interagency receipts and SDPR, and increases that we receive in that funding, since we didn't ask for any additional funding there, is strictly related to salaries at the hospital. We have positions. We try to fund our positions first with our restricted revenue sources, billing for insurance, billing to the DSH program, private insurance, and then private pay first. And then once all of those funds have been exhausted, then we start using our general funds. And so because our positions are funded there, the increases that you're seeing are due to positions.
Follow-up. Rep. Hannon for AC Suite.
And I apologize, Mr. Chairman, just because I'm not very familiar with their budget. That seems like a lot of growth, and I'm just looking for, we were able to bill more? I mean, because you didn't have a huge growth in the number of positions you had, so you're getting revenue from them for more private pay, more Medicare. It seems like a very large growth from 25 to 26 that's kind of static going to 27. So I'm not doubting that you need it. I'm just looking for understanding why we suddenly had that great leap forward.
AC Sweet.
Through the chair. Representative Hannon, I am so sorry, and I misunderstood your question. I didn't realize that you were looking at 27 actuals.
I'm looking at the 25 actuals.
Or 25 actuals to 27.
To the 26 management plan. That $17 million jump stands out to me. So I'm just looking to understand it a little more.
AC Sweet.
Thank you. So this division is one where we looked at that extra hollow authority that I spoke to. Because our positions are funded with these receipts, we get increases every year. We had excess authority. We only spent the $22 million in fiscal year 25. The 26 management shows the total authority that we had. That's greater than the amount that we actually would be able to expend. And so that's the difference. 25 is our actual expenditures that went out the door, and 27 management plan is authority that we had to spend. We had too much authority. We reduced it in 27, and you can see that we have a reduction in funds. That is even inclusive of the increases in personal services that we got over this latest year's increase because of the contract negotiations. But we still know that we have excess authority. We didn't reduce it to the point where we knew we had to the penny of what we anticipate collecting, because we do hope to collect more to help support the facility. Does that answer your question better another day? I understood.
This one,
follow up.
It
Representative
does.
Okay.
Is the full-time position count of 321 static through the three fiscal years represented on the slide? Because it's mostly personnel services is what I'm hearing you say.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it has dropped. It's 321 this year. It was 322 the year prior, and in 24 it was 325.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's continue. To slide 12.
All right. Thank you. Slide 12, we have our fiscal year 27 ask for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. The only item that we have here really is that that reduction in uncollectible authority. Again, because the majority of the positions that we fund have budget authority in IA and SDPR, each year when we get those annual increases, we get additional authority to cover them. That does not mean that we can actually claim for those expenses, and therefore it was hollow. We did do this reduction. It doesn't impact our ability to provide those services, and the remaining authority allows us the flexibility to continue to increase revenues to meet the hospital's needs.
All right. Juvenile justice.
On slide 13, we have DJJ's budget with an overall proposed budget of $73 million and six facilities. We have 13 probation offices and 421 full-time positions. The Division of Juvenile Justice meets its mission, to hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior, promote the safety and restoration of victims and communities, and assist the offenders and their families in developing skills to prevent crime. The majority of the Division of Juvenile Justice budget is in UGF, and that is made up of general fund and general fund match. Our match funding is in support of several federal grant programs, such as the reentry grant and the Title II Delinquency Prevention Formula grant. We have interagency receipts that we collect from the Department of Education for the Child Nutrition Program. We have an RSA with the Department of Labor for the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, or WIOA Youth Grant Program. And then we also, and those make up the other category.
Slide. Yes, Representative Galvin on Juvenile Justice, slide
Thank
13.
You. I'm going to wait till 15. I apologize.
Okay. No worries. Slide 14.
All right. Thank you. In fiscal year 26, we had requested an increment of $25,300 for expansion of our youth court program to our Fairbanks area. This funding was not we did not receive this funding, and therefore we did not expand the program in this service area. However, we are continuing to evaluate what the needs are within our Fairbanks area, and we'll likely be making decisions on future funding options at a later date.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to say about your youth court. My daughter, both my daughters attended the youth court. One of them stayed a clerk, so she didn't successfully go where she needed to. The other became a judge. And in doing so, she's in her junior year and is going to go on to law school. So I want you to say that the youth court works. And you're an attorney.
I am.
So now we got a conservative of them coming up the ranks. Sorry.
It's okay.
But anyways, I just want to say thank you. Yeah. Totally support this. And let's continue with the youth court for sure. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Justison. Through the chair, since we're on the slide, I was going to wait till 15, but I have a few other questions from previous slides, but we'll get to that. And through the chair, this could be for either of you. Thank you very much for being here, by the way. I wanted to did want to mention this youth court item. Off the top of your head, could you give us some ideas about like where we have other locations for youth court? And then specifically, you know, I would think that Fairbanks would be a high target area for wanting to have this. And so I'm just trying to get my head around the idea of why we wouldn't be using this resource in Fairbanks when I believe that this is a tremendously successful program and is an intervention program and ultimately saves us many thousands of dollars down the line in not just your department but in other departments. So just could you give us a little bit of an overview on this?
Commissioner.
Here for the record, Tracy Dompling, through the chair to Representative Bynum. Your question is a good one. It was one that was actually asked very similarly yesterday to Director Davidson, who had explained that youth courts have multiple funding sources, but sometimes when they have staffing issues, especially with their director of the youth courts, it's hard to sustain the program. And I used to work in Fairbanks Juvenile Probation and was very familiar with their youth court up there. And they've kind of had that phenomenon off and on, depending on who their director is that's coming in. We did indicate that we would follow up with the committee yesterday because there was the ask about what are the other funding sources that are available for this particular youth court, and we could certainly get that to this committee as well. To answer your other question, I would have to get you exactly the number of youth courts, but I know there's definitely one in Anchorage. I believe there's one in Valdez. I believe there's one in Nome. Testing my old DJJ knowledge here. So, but there's certainly more than that. I know every year they do a convening of a lot of the individuals that are working within the youth court. So, but we can get you that information of all the locations.
Thank you. Quick
follow. Yes.
Yes.
Follow-up reps
and
buying for the
commissioner, Josephson, and through the chair, we have a youth court in Ketchikan, and a tremendous community involvement. People volunteer their time. People are participating. The kids get involved. Mr. Co-Chair Josephson, this is just one of those things that I'm like, this is a no-brainer for us to be participating in this. So I just look forward to hearing more about what we can do to try to make something like this happen in Fairbanks and other places in the state if we're not participating in those other areas of the state. So thank you.
I agree, Representative Bynum. I suspect it was cut by the other body and stayed cut in the budget, clearly. So, yes, Representative Ballard.
Thank you. And through the chair, I just have a quick comment about the youth court, too. So when my daughter became a judge, she said that the kids would come in front of them, right? And it's the same type of punishment. It's no different. Mm-hmm. And she said that a lot of times the violators or potential whatever came in front of them, and they thought that their peers would be easier. And they're not. They're actually harder on their peers than adults would be. So just a fair warning. The kids go to youth court, they're probably going to get worse punishment.
And I've heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Word for
but
word.
We definitely need to do this.
All right. Stay away from those kids, right? Okay.
Very judgy.
Yeah, if they're judges. Slide 15.
On slide 15, you'll see our summary of budget items for fiscal year 27. The first being an increase for the IT class study of $60,000. This is in support of four positions that we have within the Division of Juvenile Justice. Again, this is a reduction of $550,000 in federal receipt authority. These are increases to the authority, not a reduction in any programs or a reduction of federal grants coming into the organization. And then the final item is the reestablishment of our contracted out occupational therapy program that we receive from the Mental Health Trust Authority.
Okay, Representative Galvin, on juvenile justice or any matter.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Actually, Co-Chair Joseph, and I'm going to go all the way back to slide 7, if I may. I believe this would be a question for the Assistant Commissioner Sweet. I'm looking at these numbers, and my understanding is that the Pioneer Home occupancy is it around 506? Is that what I heard? Or someone to make sure I clarify that. Has that been what is the occupancy of the Pioneer Home?
Assistant Commissioner.
Through the Chair, Representative Gavin, we have capacity of 506, and the current resident count is 388.
Okay. And through the Chair, follow up, please.
I'm so sorry.
Yes.
I looked at the wrong column. I'm sorry. It is 441.
441.
Sounds better.
Through the Chair, Acting Commissioner, or Acting, whomever wants to answer this, let's put it that way, either one of you. Is that a relatively flat rate then? Has it been going up or down over the last few years?
Commissioner Dumpling.
Sure. For the record, Tracy Dumpling. I believe it's been flat for the last few years. One of the areas that we're challenged in capacity, most of our homes are, 89 to 100% capacity. But one of them in Fairbanks is at about 58%. And that's two reasons. First of all, we had a big flooring remodel project, which there's less impact to the residents that are in the home, moving people around when we didn't have one of the wings open. Second of all, we are continuing to have staffing shortages in the assisted living aide and the certified nursing assistant, the CNA positions.
Thank you. And that does bring me to the next question about that. Thank you.
Follow
up is that I understand that roughly flat, but also it's been pretty high. Very low vacancy rate as far as residents go. And so I'm just looking at the changes here in terms of the 26-27. It looks very flat. And if the challenge is in your UGF, which I understand is where that funding is used primarily to support the care of the patients. And the turnover rate is high at 22%, and I haven't seen any ask for, and in this case, as you can see, we're flat. We're flat funding it, and I'm trying to understand how it can stay flat if costs naturally one would think are going up, not putting aside the major maintenance that needs to happen. I know that you have experienced the same costs as everywhere else with regard to costs of providing services, let alone paying these care providers who are currently getting paid. I believe last I heard it was 32% under the national average rate. That was what we heard just last week from the Guidehouse, is that in general these providers roughly are not making anywhere near what would be, I guess, competitive. And so I'm just asking if you have any comments about whether or not you think that you can find a way to recruit and retain with the same number of dollars this coming year. So that you can provide, I think what you said was the best life experience, end of life. The term you used was so lovely, and I do want to, be present about that and make sure that we're following what we as a state say we want to do and provide for our elders.
Commissioner.
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Galvin, I did just want to touch base because of my prior experience at behavioral health, that I believe the Guidehouse study was really looking actually at the Medicaid reimbursement costs, not necessarily the cost that the state of Alaska is paying for its staff. Just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
Yes.
So. Do you have any further, if I may follow up, any further comments, though, on how it seems to be that your UGS is stagnant and so is your pretty high I think your number of vacancies are low, so you're going to have a lot of the same number, if not more, residents. And as soon as that project gets fixed in Fairbanks, even more. So, and yet you're not asking for any more UGF, and just want to make sure that you have a plan for that.
Through the AC suite.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gavin. Our UGF in the payment assistance program is there to help support elders who either don't have long-term care insurance, who aren't on Medicaid, or who do not have private pay. So the payment assistance program, while our current rates, for example, are less than what the operational costs are. So every one of our elders in the home gets subsidized so that it covers the difference between the rate that we have currently and what the actual cost of each of our homes is. Then their insurance is applied, and then if they apply for payment assistance, then they receive payment assistance funds. So that's the general funds that you see is the bulk of what we have within the Pioneer homes. We utilize the general funds when, as a payer of last resort, to ensure that the elders have a home and that they have a place to live through the remainder of their life. And that was the entire intent of the program. But it is the payer of last resort. So you don't see an increase there. We were short, as you heard last year, part of it is because we had more elders that didn't have long-term care insurance or wasn't covered by Medicaid and didn't have any of their own assets to cover their cost. And so, but it changes on a daily basis, which makes it really difficult, right? Because it's dependent on the elders that we have inside of the home and their ability to pay. And again, also what level of care they need. So did that help answer? It's variable depending on that.
I think we should just move on. In general, I was looking at this in a different direction. I'm more concerned about, are we reaching the level of care that we need to reach by hiring the appropriate amount? When I look at the turnover and such, I was more concerned about, do you have enough to cover your operating costs, not how you're operating them? But I think it's fine to move on. Thank you so much, Representative Josephson.
Sure. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and through the chair to the department. I appreciate Representative Galvin bringing this question up. Pioneer Homes and facilities that provide these types of services are extremely important to Alaskans. And especially down in my area, District 1, in our community, we see that we have an aging population. We see that the wait list for trying to get into Pioneer Homes is extremely long. It's very difficult to get in. I think I probably should try to get myself on the list now so that I can get there eventually. But my question really is what kind of collaboration is happening between your department and other departments to try to soften the need of going into this, if any? And I can rephrase the question if it's necessary.
Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. I am not familiar with any sort of engagement with other departments to stop people from needing to go into the Pioneer Home. And if you are age 60, you can certainly get on the wait list. There's an inactive wait list that you can get on until you're ready to move in. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we do have increasing wait lists. And then this year also, to add to that, was they streamlined the application process. So instead of a cumbersome paper application, they made it an online application, which made it easier for people to apply. And yes, you have 96 individuals on the wait list at the Ketchikan Pioneer Home.
Yes. And I'll follow up, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, offline on this. I think it's a super important topic. One quick follow-up.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair to the department. When we went through this slide the first time, you had mentioned Medicaid briefly. Representative Galvin had mentioned talking about the rate study. I think overall, when we talk about your departments, your department and all of the services that you're providing, have you evaluated how the implementation of that rate study might impact your ability to provide services and be more competitive? So when we go back to slide 3, you talked about vacancies and positions and that, you know, we're really having a hard time in being competitive. And so I'm assuming that part of what we're trying to deal with is reimbursable rates and our ability to then pay people to do the work, the hard work that needs to be done is challenged because of our ability to pay them. And so I'm just really curious on, we had that presentation with us here. I believe they told us that if we fully implemented rates, it'd be about $45 million. There'd be additional $110 million in federal money that would come in. I'm just trying to think about, has the department really evaluated that, tried to see how it would impact the department, and whether or not it would actually help with a lot of these vacancy issues, because it's, you know, it impedes your ability to do your job.
Commissioner. So,
to the chair, to Representative Bynum, we can engage certainly more with the Department of Health as far as, you know, if there are increases to reimbursement rates, if the specific reimbursement rates for those assisted living homes that I believe was what they were looking at will equally apply to the assisted living home reimbursement rates within the Pioneer Homes.
And a follow-up?
Yes, last follow-up, if it might.
Thank you. Last follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair to the department. The vacancy positions, when you talked about us losing personnel outside of the department, what is your biggest, I guess the word, right, maybe the wrong word, but the word I'm going to use is competition. Where are we losing our staffing to? And have we evaluated what we actually need to do to be directly competitive to keep them? So I'd hate for us to be continuously doing this cycle of training, and then they run off, and I don't know, like, where is it that we're losing the people to? And it could be a lot of different places. So I'm just hoping for some input.
Sure.
Commissioner, or AC Suite.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, while I don't have that exact here now, I can tell you that the majority of the staff at the Department of Family and Community Services sees going out of our department are outside of state government. But I do have a tool that we have built that tracks the staff that are coming and leaving and identifies if they're transferring to other departments, if they're getting promotions within our organization, and I would be happy to provide that information to this body.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. With that, we're going to take a very brief at ease to invite Ms. Gui up. Commissioner, are you going to stay with us?
Yes.
Okay. We'll be at ease just for a moment. We're at ease. Hey, we're back on record in the Al Adams Room on Friday, the 27th of February. The subject now is the Office of Children's Services at DFCS. If folks have questions for the auditor, she, Ms. Curtis, is online from Anchorage. The others, of course, are here. There's also an assistant, there's another auditor named Christine Lumba, who's also available in Anchorage. But we'll proceed with the remainder of the slide deck. Ms. Gui, do you want to do this, or is it AC Suite? AC Suite.
Hi. For the record, Marion Sweet. So the Office of Children's Services has 608 full-time positions in 21 offices across the state with a budget of $111.1 million. UGF authority within the Office of Children's Services is made up of general funds, general fund match, and general fund mental health. The match is in support of multiple federal grant programs, the largest of which is Title IV-E, which provides funding for foster care, adoptions, and guardianships. Some other grant programs that we have are the Independent Living Program, we have Social Services Block Grant, and we have Safe and Stable Families, promoting safe and stable families, just to name a few. General fund program receipts are in the DGF category, and this is where we collect our child support and our Social Security income. And then additionally, we have interagency receipts where we collect things like funding from the Department of Health for providing child care for working foster providers, as well as funding to help support facilitated attuned training for all of our OCS staff. Thank you. On page 17, we will go over our fiscal year 26 items, the first of which is an increase that we received of $5.5 million in funding for the child advocacy centers. This is funding that replaces two previous fund sources, the first of which was $3.4 million from the Office of Children's Services that we paid for using temporary assistance or for needy families or TANF funding that we received from an RSA with the Department of Health, as well as the $1.2 million that the CACs received directly from a grant from the Department of Justice. Because the original funding that we had awarded to the CACs was on a three-year competitive program, we offered a second solicitation so that we could ensure that other CACs within the state beyond the 12 that we already had agreements for had an opportunity to apply. However, no other CACs applied, and so we did issue grant amendments to award the full balance to our 12 CACs. That was as of January, at the beginning of January, $5.3 million had been awarded. Two of our CAC partners have declined. I was told that it was because they were able to receive additional funding from federal agencies. And then we are still waiting on responses from a third CAC to see if they will accept the grant award or not. And then we also had 200 of that funding was going to be dedicated to providing specialized training to our CAC beneficiaries.
Slide 18.
And slide 18 is our 27 budget items, and the first of which is the reduction of uncollectible authority. The IA is the remaining amount that was held over from that RSA that I spoke on earlier that we used to have with public assistance for child support or child care services, and then the other is federal and program receipt authority that is beyond our ability to collect. And then the last item is the Office of Children's Services has three IT positions, and this is the increase to their budget to support those three positions based off of that IT job class study.
All right. Before we hear from the director, we have questions from Reps Galvin and Stapp.
Thank you. Just real briefly, it looks like maybe some of the grant funding you were getting on the federal side has been reduced. It was 5.6 and now it's at 3.9. Can you tell me what that was? Let me go back to what it is. This is DGF funds. I'm guessing those were grants, federal grants maybe. And so in 2026... There's a reduction from 2026 to 2027.
Through the chair, Representative Gavin, we reduced $1.6 million in general fund program receipt authority. The general fund program receipts is the collection of child support and Social Security income. The authority that we had was beyond anything that we have been able to historically collect. It was just a reduction of hollow authority.
I see. Okay. Thank you. That explains it.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Coach. Just through the chair to AC Suite. $5.5 million for CSCs. How much of that have you distributed, and how much of that do you still have through the chair?
Okay, she answered that, but let's hear it again. AC Suite.
Through the chair, we had issued grant awards up to $5.3 million, and of that, $480,000-ish was declined. All the rest has been awarded to grantees.
Okay, thanks.
And we talked about this topic yesterday afternoon.
Thank you, yes.
The Commission on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault reports that because of further decline in VOCA dollars, there needs to be more back, or some other federal source, there needs to be more backfilling of the child advocacy centers, notwithstanding that all of these dollars are not yet subscribed. And I think I asked you, does that sound right to you based on your present knowledge? And I think you said yes. Do you recall that exchange?
To the chair, yes.
Okay, and why is it that they need another $1.5 million?
To the chair, I believe it's because they were receiving those funds and providing those services to the communities, and those services are needed throughout Alaska. And without that funding, it is a detriment to them being able to continue to provide care to children and families that go seek services at the CACs.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead. Thank you. I don't see any other questions, and we'll go to slide 19. Director.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kim Gway. I'm the Director of Office of Children's Services. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I've been asked to share some information about the audit of what we call House Bill 151. But in addition to, before I dig into that, I wanted to share there was additional attachments with data on five-year trends at Office of Children's Services. There's more information about the House Bill 151 and caseload standards. There's additional dollars, budget slides on there about adoption and subsidies. So if there's questions on that throughout, please let me know. But primarily I've been asked to talk about the audit that we have completed. So this first slide kind of gives you a broad overview. House Bill 151 passed unanimously in June of 2018. This was a significant bill for Office of Children's Services, and we were very happy and supportive of the support that we got from the legislature. Our first audit happened in November of 2020. And so, So the first audit, November of 2020, came with four different recommendations. And this audit spanned what just came out in 2025, so it was a five-year audit. Many of the recommendations from the legislative auditor, unfortunately, were technical in nature, and the auditors had said that this bill, unfortunately, did not change outcomes for children and families at the Office of Children's Services, which is, in fact, true. But not for the lack of trying. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that and kind of where we're at and what some recommendations are at the end of this. I won't go verbatim and read every slide, but I want to talk about the recommendations of Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. So you'll see in these first slides the first four recommendations in Part 1 in 2020. Some of them were things of the nature of tracking things within our ORCA system, making sure that we are getting that information in there in regards to relative search, for example. There were also additional things in there, can go to the next slide, about updating our ORCA system as far as the security. And so what that means is when they were doing the audit, they had found we were missing some authorizations from employees that had to sign a piece of paper that said they have rights to be in the system. We were missing a few of those, so we had to go back and make sure that those were completed and those were updated. And so that was a recommendation number four, for example. Recommendation three was an updated to a regulation, which we were working on prior to 151, in regards to getting changing the 7AAC 67130, which is a licensing foster care licensing regulation, and so those all were completed, with the exception of recommendation recommendation one, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that because that recommendation does pop up later into this, into another part three of the audit.
Okay. Recommendation one, you wanted to discuss it further?
I'm going to now go on. I'm doing this in an order of time. So,
got it.
Yep.
Okay. We have a question for Rep. Galvin.
Thank you. I think what I heard you say, but I want to make sure I heard it correctly, that it wouldn't change any of the outcomes for the children. Is that what I heard you say, that in terms of the recommendations, they were technical in nature and would not have made an impact in terms of outcomes?
Director Gui.
Did I hear that?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, and that's what the audit report also concluded, is that unfortunately the passing of 151 did not equate to better outcomes, and there's a reason for that, which is our caseloads. Our caseloads are high, and we have not been able to. Part of this bill was capping our caseload averages, and we have not been able to do that due to the volume of work and the lack of employees that are working at Office of Children's Services.
Thank you. I just
follow up
for Chair
Trezeson. But just remember that this is a two-part, really three-part presentation.
Understood, and I think that's what I'm trying to clarify, is that what I heard was not relevant to this, and I was thinking that these four recommendations were followed, and that did not have outcome changes, and that's not what you're saying. I just want to clarify that for the record. Thank you.
Sure. To be clear, I mean, the passage was when Governor Walker signed it, and of course that wouldn't change anything except the future, which is the important part. It's the implementation that we're talking about. And so, for example, in the relative and family friend searches, I think the hope of the bill was not just to find family members, but to enlist them as registered, licensed foster care folks. And had that fully happened, and maybe you'll assert that it did in its best possible way, but if it had fully happened, the results would have improved because you have familial structure and familiarity that comes with that. But let's push on to where you want to be.
Thank you, Chair Jessison. And before I jump in, I wanted to commend you on that example and give you, for the audit itself said that the law says that a supervisor has to certify. They have to write a note saying a relative search has been done. 98% of our cases have relatives entered. We have more relatives, children in relative placements than the country. We're over 50%. The national average is in the 40s. And so we are doing well in relative placements. We have seen an uptick in that. We have seen a decline in foster home placements. But one of the things that we are trying to express to the auditor, we do have relatives in there. What we're missing and why we're being dinged is because a supervisor didn't write a note within our system. And if we created a checkbox in our system, it was going to cost us $2 million to change an archaic system. And it didn't make sense because we have relatives at the table. We are working with our tribes. So there is all sorts of other ways to be able to show that we are meeting this outcome, but we just didn't certify it. So that's what I mean by a technical change. Okay, so jumping, 2020 is when the first audit came out.
But Director, the certification is what gives confidence to those in the outer world that it's happening. That's important, isn't it?
Chair Josephson, I don't know. I mean, how would you know I certified? You don't have access into our system, right? That's part of the problem. How you would know is by that we have more children with placements, with relatives. We have more children that are receiving respite care from relatives. And so the certification it wasn't going to change the amount of relatives that we have already in there. We were prioritizing that. We are working with our tribes to also get more relatives to the table, and that's under the Child Welfare Compact. So, and, we're short-staffed, and so for a supervisor to do something that we know that we are working on and we are showing outcomes, it didn't make a lot of sense for us to say, make sure you go write a note saying that we're already doing it.
All right.
So,
Rep Allard for the director.
Thank you. This kind of fired me up a little bit. It might, through the chair, might not change the outcome, but it can change the accountability. So for me, saying it costs $2 million and it's not worth it, I would disagree with you. There's a lot of things that I'll do the skinny on financially, but on this one, I wouldn't. I think $2 million to make a change where it holds the individual checking to see if there's family members for the child is important. And if they don't annotate it, then for me, I don't know that they actually did follow through with it, right? Number one. And then you would have to go back and ask them, did you? And then they could say yes. But if they have to check a box, then we know they did it or they're lying. I know you're short-staffed. I just find it inexcusable.
Okay, let's go to slide 22.
Thank you. So in 2020, height of pandemic, they did the audit. And then what happened between audit one and audit two? So audit two happens in 2023, so 3 years later. During that time, however, we were working on, we had our highest turnover at 59%. 59% of our staff were leaving. We were challenged on how to do the work. We were challenged on getting out and making sure our children were safe. We were challenged on finding people to come work at OCS. We weren't seeing applicants. So we were really juggling on trying to figure out how to bring people in the door, how to train them. Our training moved to virtual because we were not doing anything in person, except we were still out knocking on people's doors and, you know, taking care of children and doing our monthly contact visits and things of that nature. We had implemented... during this time, we have implemented a gradual case assignment when new workers come on the job. What ended up shifting is we are trying to really make sure that we were bringing people on slowly, understanding the job, but what was happening is our staff that had the experience were getting higher caseloads, which persisted with turnover. During this time, we had talked with the governor. And the governor had launched what's called the People's First Initiative, which was amazing for us because it allowed us to do things differently. He gave us 26 additional positions. We were able to do retention bonuses for our staff that are, you know, sitting in cars with children that had COVID and all these other things, knocking on doors, going into contentious environments. We got a wellness and resiliency officer. We implemented critical incident debriefing. There was a lot of different things that we were trying to keep staff there and doing the job. The retention bonuses, that was over a span of 2 years, and it was successful. We have been able to retain many of those people. At least 48% of those people continue to work at Office of Children's Services.
Okay, just so I hear the words again. Retention bonuses were successful for those four words. Right?
Yes, okay. For the most part. There's definitely some compression that's happening with our line staff compared to our management. So a lot of people, because we're giving retention bonuses to line staff, they didn't want to promote into supervisor positions. So that is something that we're experiencing. For example, the Juneau field office, I have not been able to recruit a supervisor for 10 months. Anchorage, I have 3 supervisors. I'm short, and I can't find people to hire. So we are seeing issues with leadership positions.
Representative Stapp, Galvin Bynum.
Yeah, thank you, Coacher Justin, through the chair. Okay, so maybe, and that might have to go to Auditor Curtis, because it clearly states on page 11 of the third part of the audit that, quote, the legislature also authorized additional funding for bonuses, mental health support, tuition reimbursement, and other retention incentives for a total increase in personal services of $20.7 million. Despite these actions, significant progress in addressing the labor issues did not materialize. Okay? That, in the audit, sounds materially different from what you just said, which was the retention bonuses worked. So maybe clarification through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp.
Director Gray.
The staff that I have that have been there. I have a lot of staff that have been there that are 10-year-plus employees. They haven't left. And so what I have is a lot of turnover, though. I mean, our turnover rate is high, but it's the lower-level, entry-level, PSS, Protective Service Specialists, 1s and 2s. Some 3s leave, but we have also expanded the career ladder. What I will say is, yes, 48% are still there, but we still have a retention and recruitment problem.
Can you follow up? And then this would be to Ms. Curtis if she's on the line.
Rep Stapp for Ms. Curtis. Ms. Curtis, are you with us telephonically?
Hi, for the record, this is Chris Curtis, legislative auditor.
Rep Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, through the chair. Can you just clarify, Ms. Curtis, if I'm getting this correct? I'm reading your audit, and then I'm listening to the comments, and they seem a little bit in conflict through the chair.
Ms. Curtis.
Through the chair, representative staff, yes, you're reading the audit correctly. We did conclude that the AC-151, along with other actions by the legislature over a period of years, did not translate into addressing the core problem for OCS, which is vacancies and turnover. But likely, some of those things we do mention in the audit, such as retention incentives, did help mitigate the labor issues. In other words, if they hadn't had some of those, retention incentives or mental health assistance, would it have been worse? Likely. But in the big picture, the intention of 151 was to help improve the outcomes of Alaska children by reducing vacancy and turnover through various things, mostly caseload caps, and we did not see that come to fruition.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up, Representative Stapp for the auditor.
I think I'm going to go back to the
Representative Stapp for Director Guay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair to Director Guay. So just to kind of close out this thought, because this was the longer question I was going to ask anyways. In conclusion one in the audit, which is basically referencing what we're talking about here, that you state that it's the emotional toll, the weather, the frustration, and workers are underpaid for the high demands of the job given the dangerous and volatile situations that they encounter. And that's kind of the reasons listed for the turnover issues. And my question to you is, how do I, as an appropriator, deal with things like the geography and the weather and the stress of the job? Like, how do I quantify that into something to help you with retention? Through the chair.
Director.
Through the chair, Rep Stapp, I think that's a great question. To me, I think that we have to get creative on how to solve some of these issues. And that's a hard one to figure out. We are challenged. For example, what we need to do is I need more rural housing for my staff. We have a location home that we rent in Nome, and we have a home that we rent in Dillingham. That's two locations around rural Alaska. We have to think differently about the work and how it's done in rural Alaska. I would love to hire more locals, but that is not the folks that are coming to our table. And so right now we have a lot of staff that do a week on, week off. They work 2 weeks in that 1 week that they're there. But then what happens when they're on leave the next week or on their time off? And so we're trying to straddle how to do this work. GGU just passed this last contract, was able to negotiate different salary schedules, different work schedules, excuse me. And so I think that there's some opportunity in there. But we are trying to think about how to do things differently than we've done before. But I think housing is one. And I have a slide further on in the slide deck kind of talking about some things that I think that would be unique on how to do things differently. I will say that we have looked at, like, what can we reduce? We usually every year look at what we call stop doing. It becomes a moral dilemma, though. Like, who do we choose not to serve? Do we stop investigating high-risk cases? Do we stop responding at midnight when, you know, law enforcement has picked up children and, you know, we're, you know, do we see them at 8 in the morning? So we are stretched too thin. And here's the thing, is I have enough positions, I just don't have the staff to fill them. If I had all my positions filled, the caseloads would be well under the caseload averages. They would be around, I think, 10 to 11.
And go ahead.
I'll yield to you, Mr. Chair, and then follow.
All right. Well, I don't. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. So, I mean, I know we do things very bureaucratic when we talk about salary studies and stuff, but, you know, when I look at this problem, these vacancies are very high and they persist for many years. Why not simply delete half of them and add them back at higher ranges through the chairs?
Director.
Through the chair, Rep. Svap, I appreciate the question. And I don't know if I have the authority to do that. But
I think,
I like the
I
idea.
I think I do, though.
I like the idea.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, Rep. Svap asked the question I asked. I effectively asked it yesterday. You sound unsure whether you have the authority. And I think, speaking for myself and perhaps Rep. Svap, that we need someone to pound on the door until they're told to just go away.
Yeah.
And we haven't heard that. Rep. Galvin.
I appreciate that, Co-Chair Josephson. I have a couple of questions along the lines of hiring and also of what we're doing once we hire. Because in here I do see quite a few of the recommendations. I'm looking at slide well, it's in a few places, but it's around training the folks who we do hire. There seems to be a need to do that, and I don't see it on slide 26, even though there it's mentioned here several times, creating specific training, improved training, and clarified expectations. Built-in management and supervisory accountability and oversight, I would call that in the Department of Training as well. And this could be simply also a lack of people. I appreciate that, but I would like to hear that because in all of these recommendations, there's comments around how to build a workforce that's ready to do the work. And in number slide 26, it's more about what we're doing to offer, incentivize folks to come into the workforce. And I appreciate that. But did you have a plan for training that just didn't get worked out because you didn't have enough staffing or supervisory positions filled in order to do that?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, thank you for the question. With the passing of HB 151, we moved to 6 weeks of training, and we had started that, and then the pandemic hit, right, and it was in-person training. We went to online training. And then when we came out of the pandemic, our workers looked a little bit different. The people that were coming to our door looked different because we're not a telework agency, right? People have to knock on doors, and those, you know, I know one of the questions earlier, where are people going? They're going where they can telework, which is not our agency. But one of the things that we did is we've been evaluating our training every year. We used to have 80% of our caseworkers were degreed, whether it's bachelor's or master's. We're up to around 50% are non-degreed right now, and they're coming with less case management experience. Usually, if they didn't have a degree, they at least had some case management experience. So we've been pivoting our training, I would say, almost every year to try to accommodate what our new people look like.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up. But I want to get I don't think I have a cutoff of 3:30, but the world may. Rep. Galvin, quick follow-up.
Yeah, there are a couple of systemic suggestions also were made and wondered if those were followed through. Decreasing the size of the foster care application to improve processing time. Secondly, what was done with regard to foster children and use rights?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, we reduced the foster care application down to 13 pages. It was, my understanding, I believe over 30, high 30s, so we reduced it quite significantly. Mm-hmm. We also reduced the amount of time it takes to become licensed foster parents, so we did complete that. As far as the rights for youth, we have worked on with, typically with FFCA, mm-hmm. on rights brochures. There are quite a few different important documents when youth age out that we work with the youth on, such as their Social Security, BIA, and things of that nature. And we are still continuing to do that.
So follow up, if I may.
You may. But once again, look, I know this is hugely important. No. Go ahead. I need to get Ms. Mativier and Rep. Guerra here.
Okay. Fair enough. I just want to really drive home that, you know, that when we talk about youth rights, I know from my perspective, I've experienced things around patient rights, for example, and for youth to be brought out and in and out and in and out of so many homes without a sense of what they have a right for so that they can even advocate for themselves. So it's not just what is it like when they leave at 18, 19, 20, 21, but what is it like for them when they're experiencing something in real time and they know it doesn't feel right, but they're not sure. And what is their right to do something there? And that's what I'm just not sure what we have built in systemically. It doesn't feel like whatever we do have built in is working. And I just wanted to make sure to voice that. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks. I know you have a lot of other things to cover.
That was good insight. Who are their advocates, Director?
Chair Josephson, they have guardian ad litem. Every child that comes into care has a GAL. Some of them also have CASAs. Depending on their age, we also try to connect them with
the acronyms.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Guardian ad litem. They're with the Office of Public Advocacy. The CASA is
Court-appointed special advocate.
I'm like, what was the C? And that's a volunteer organization, and it's a great group that works. We would love there to be more of them. But it's a great group that works with families that are in care primarily with the children.
Okay. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. If this is my only time to ask questions of the three members from the department, then I'll ask it now. But otherwise, I'd prefer to wait until we get to the end of the slideshow, if I can do that.
Well, let's do that.
Thank you.
Let's power through this slideshow. And what I'd ask of the committee is to get right into the question, right? So a sentence.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Can I give a sentence?
I'm speaking to my committee members. Mm-hmm. No, we're going to go through the slideshow and then
at the end?
Yes.
Okay.
Director.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go on to the next slide. So now is part two of the audit, which was in November of 2023. This one came with six different recommendations, and I did mention when Representative Galvin asked some questions about the number of days for an application is now 43 days. There was a lot of work that we did on these different recommendations. Let me think what else here. Report. Yeah, many of these I've already spoken to, so I'm going to keep moving unless there's any specific questions on to audit, in between audit two and three.
Okay. So you're advancing to slide 26. Slide 26.
Thank you. So as I mentioned, audit two was in 2023, and then audit three was in completed in 2024, the report came out in 2025. So these are some of the items that we are working on in between. And again, a lot of these came from the People's First Initiative. What we were really focused on was trying to figure out how to retain and recruit staff. And so we stood up a safety officer. We stood up facilitating attunement training, which is reflective supervision. We worked with the University of Alaska to create a child welfare certificate. We created crisis debriefing. There is numerous things that we are really working on and trying to retain our staff and meet what the needs. We do annual surveys. We do exit surveys. I meet with my staff every other month in what we call fireside chats, trying to engage them. I have staff advisory boards. I have supervisor leadership councils. We have a lot of voices that we're trying to bring to the table to make sure that we are aligned with what they need. It's with those voices that I come and I talk every year about what they say they need and why they are thinking about leaving, what my exit surveys say. And what I consistently come and say is they say the job is difficult and the pay is not good, right? It's not commensurate with the work that they're doing. But people come to this work because they're drawn to the passion of this work. But the secondary trauma, the burnout that happens is real. And so I just say that, you know, those are the things that our staff are telling us. In addition to that, lately it's been on call. And what that means is after they do their 40 hours a week, they're having to take calls at night with emergencies. We are having placement crises, so when we have children that we don't have placements for, they're sleeping in hotels with these kiddos or in the office with these children. So they're working an extreme amount of time and overtime. And so that's a problem. People are burning out, and they need a break because this job is hard. And so that was some of the recruitment, what they're saying, what they're sharing. And then I talk about some of the recruitment strategies. We've updated position descriptions. We've created real-life videos on the website. We have changed our hiring. We used to be primarily bachelor's education or some kind of work experience. Now it's competency-based hiring. You know, if we didn't change, we would have even less applicants than what we have now. I don't know that I love it, but at least it's bringing more people to the table because less people want to do this work than previously. There's not a lot of people that are coming forward, and so we need, like as I mentioned, a lot of our staff now, over 50% are non-degreed, and so that is just our reality, and so we're trying to pivot and do what we can to make that successful. We have paid internships. Every year we have anywhere from 8 to 7 to 15 interns across the state. We pay them to do their internship with us. Let's see. We've been doing a lot of recruitment events across the state. We've been working with universities. We go to job fairs. We go to different events such as AFN or BIA. So we're trying to get out there. We're trying to get people to apply. We worked with the University of Denver, really looking at their quality improvement center and get to the value-based hiring. So we've been doing quite a bit of work to try to get to better outcomes. I'm on the fence where I think it's overall successful.
What is the starting salary for PSS 1?
$28.50.
Okay. And what is your vacancy right now in the PSS category, any PSS category?
Chair Joseph, for the case-carrying staff, 40%. For all OCS, it's 32%.
How many humans is the 40% of the case-carrying?
211.
That's how many jobs you could hire now.
That's how many case-carrying protective service specialists I have.
What happens to those dollars at the end of the year that have been appropriated?
Chair Justin, we use the money. Is that your question? What do we?
So 211 times 100,000 is a lot of money. What? Where do those resources go? On June 30th, are they spent?
Typically, they are spent. We do a lot of overtime. We do a lot of on call. So we are typically using those dollars.
All right. Let's finish up your slide deck.
All right, we are on to part three of the audit. Again, this was completed at the end of 2024 and was released in June of 25. With this came 7 recommendations. The first 2 recommendations, there were some numbers that were askew in our system. We had some turnover in our admin that were keeping track of this. I had a 7-month vacancy, and so we lost some positions in transit So we have corrected this. We are now using smart sheets, and that is dialed in. Recommendations 3 and 4, a more comprehensive training program. We have 7 weeks training right now, and we are moving into a new iteration of training come July 1. Of that 7 weeks, we have one in person, and then we have our mentors that go out with our new staff for 3 of those weeks. So it's not all in person like it used to be pre-COVID. We do have some online, but that online is, it's not like they're just by themselves clicking away. It's a classroom environment where they are learning and discussing and talking. We do what's called transfer of learning opportunities. So we are trying to blend the learning, how they learn the job. And again, we're evaluating it and then making changes as necessary. We have talked to our staff about bringing training back in person, but people do not want to be away from their home for 6 weeks. And, you know, I would say predominantly our staff are females, and they do not want to leave home for 6 weeks for $28 an hour. So we have met them where they're at and are trying to figure out how to make that work.
But that means the law is not complied with?
No, the law is, Chair Justin, it is complied. It doesn't say it has to be in person. It just says that we have to have 6 weeks of training.
Right. I'm recalling because in 2018 there was no online training.
Correct. Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. So
times change
please,
fast.
Please continue.
Recommendation 4. This one, and I have a slide a little bit later to address this, so I'm not going to go into it right now, but it's got some important pieces to it. During this time frame, we stood up a talent acquisition team, and we're still making some tweaks to this, but we were looking at some efficiencies. With 21 field offices and 21 offices trying to hire their own people, there was a lot of inefficiencies. So we did create a talent acquisition team that's housed within the department that is working with OCS and trying to hire some folks. So that's what our TA team is.
Okay.
And then we do have a 5-year forward-looking plan. That's also in one of your attachments that I have that we've submitted.
Okay. Importantly, Representative Ruffridge asked, what is it that you need, and is that in this deck?
Yes, sir. It is slide...
Slide 33.
Let's just jump to that one, which is... One more back.
Mm-hmm. And noteworthy was the PCG report, which noted that defined benefits would help. The director noted that this is not her report, it's their PCG's report. But there it is, Public Consulting Group recommended enhancing pensions, among many other things. Okay.
Yes. So
I think we're going to take a few more questions and then go to Reps Guerra and Ms. Mativier. Question on this side. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair to the commissioner, acting commissioner. I don't even know where to begin. I know that this has been an ongoing problem, and I'm not in a position to set policy from the policy committee perspective, but we are here on the finance committee to be able to provide resources necessary to solve this problem, Commissioner. And this isn't just something that's cropped up over the last 2 years. It goes back to 2018, and it is a persistent problem. We have an education system in the state. When I talk to my superintendents around the state, they tell me they have crisis in the classroom, and the crisis in the classroom is because of your department, because of not being able to take care of these kids. It bleeds into the schools. They see it every day. And so who's been responsible for oversight of this problem for the last 8 years?
For the record, Tracy Dompling through the chair to Representative Bynum. That would be our department. Our department is responsible for the oversight. We're the ones that are responsible for, trying to address the issues that are happening within, the divisions within the department.
Can follow up, Rep. Bynum.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Is there any one specific person been tasked to be responsible, or is it just in general department?
to the chair to Representative Bynum. I mean, I assume that that lies with the commissioner. I mean, ultimately, the commissioner is the highest level of authority within the department. You know, we certainly, I think that the division, you know, and people have disagreed with me on this, I think the division has done things to try to make changes. I do want to touch on the salary issue because salary issue continues to come up. We have continuously shared that. We recently, just recently, within the last few weeks, did receive the approval for a class study for this particular class. And one of the things that we've explained with this particular job class is it's not just the protective services specialist is not just Office of Children's Services staff. There are individuals who work with other within other departments who, and not to downgrade their work, but they sit behind a desk and they have probably never had to respond to a home and seen a bruised and battered child. It's very difficult, and it has been in the past, I think, to break out of that. And so that's one of the things that we've asked for is to really look at this particular job class and hone in on the work that our staff at the Office of Children's Services are doing so that we can make sure that we're adequately paying them at a rate that will hopefully recruit. Now, I don't believe, and I'm just stating this from my personal opinion, I think there is always going to be an issue with retention. Hopefully it's not to the percentage it is now, but I've, you know, said to myself before, like, look inside myself and wonder, how much money would you have to pay me an hour to see the things and hear the things that our staff are hearing and seeing the atrocities that are happening to children? How long as a human being could I stay in that role? So I think that there's always going to be some level of turnover. But my hope then is the work that the leadership at Office of Children's Services is doing through all of these things is working to make sure that the culture within that organization is one that when that person reaches that saturation point, like I can't do this part of the work anymore, that they want to stay within the organization because the culture is one that is supportive of the employees so that we don't lose the experience that that person has and the knowledge that they have put into the work over the years.
Follow up.
But my intention is at 3:20 p.m. to ask these professionals, who I'm grateful to, to kindly remove themselves to the next set of seats so that we can transition. So that's in less than 3 minutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, for the latitude. We obviously are not going to have the opportunity here to really get to the answers I think that we will need to have at some point to figure out what we're doing financially. But my final question and to the commissioner is, through the chair to the commissioner, is who is doing a good job at this agency-wise? And I'm not talking about within the state, but who is doing a phenomenal job with this type of work? And are we trying to mirror that? Who are we coordinating with? Because this thing that we have going here has been broken for years, is in disrepair, and what we're doing now doesn't seem to be really fixing it at all. So if this was an electric utility, those are the things I know, I would have fired everybody and I'd start over. And I'd have to model differently because this isn't working. So who are we modeling after? Who are we looking at and modeling it after? And if you can name somebody, do we have a plan to make that happen?
Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I will start this. I know that the team has traveled to a few other states. I've heard reference to the Ohana Care that is happening in Hawaii. I believe the team also went to Oklahoma. There are a few states. Child welfare is a challenge in every state in this country, and so there are a few states that are doing better. That we can look at. Now, I have also talked to Director Gui about, you know, looking at I feel like it potentially makes sense to bring in a contractor who is familiar with child welfare, who can come in, and in the way it's been described to me is kind of soup to nuts, looks at the organization, the, you know, the work that's being done, how work is assigned to staff, to really give some concrete recommendations that we can work from. I think that they've done... we had recently the back to basics that they were working on, which is really what are the basic things that need to be done. Some moved the needle, some didn't. And so we've gone back to the drawing board and said, what is it that we can do to move that needle?
Okay. So, sorry, we're going to go to Rep. Allard. We're going to, and these folks will be back.
Hi.
On Saturday, today's Friday, tomorrow's Saturday, there is a children's caucus event. I don't know who it's open to, but I think it's devoted to this and related topics in the Terry Miller Gym. It is not, I think, open to the public. I'm not sure. I don't know. Rep. Allard, do you have a quick question?
Yeah. So you just kind of admitted on record that the entire system in the state of Alaska needs to have a complete overhaul and that we need to be bring in private contractors. You've also said that there's an issue with salaries. So I get that. And my heart is out there because I do know that for individuals to see things every single day, like soldiers or police officers or first responders, it's a lot. So I probably don't have a real question at this moment, exception to you can get back on me how you're working, getting the Social Security and identification for these individuals, these children, so they can get out into the system. How are we helping them get those things? And then I wanted to hit on... Yeah, I'm just going to leave it there. I really want to. I got to go. I want to hear from Representative Guerra.
Okay, thank you, ladies. We're going to go at ease briefly. We're back on record in the Al Adams room at 3:23. And so we have before us Ms. Mativier and Mr. Guerra. If you'll put your names on the record, I would like to hear from you about your response both to the performance of House Bill 151, compliance with House Bill 51, but also the department's view of its response to the audit, et cetera. Who would like to begin?
Good afternoon, Amanda Mativier. I'm the Executive Director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska.
Good afternoon, former Representative Les Guerra.
Representative Guerra, would you like to begin?
You know, on your question, what should be done, that's what we're here to talk about. On your question, what's our response to the Office of Children's Services, if I could hold off on that, we'd like to do productively talk to this committee about what the legislature can do, because I think it's very clear legislative involvement is needed after 8 years with the Office of Children's Services now 8 years into HB 151 saying they're thinking about looking at things.
I think your suggestion is more constructive than the way I posed it. So what should be done?
Can we go through the slides
sure.
instead of me blurting out an answer?
Please
sure.
proceed.
Thank you. So for those who didn't follow, in 2018, over the course of 2 years, the legislature across party lines passed House Bill 151. OCS sometimes refers to it as my bill, and it is not my bill. The Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Kelly, Senator McKinnon, a 15-5 Republican-led Senate, every single member of the Senate stood up and cross-sponsored this bill on the Senate floor. Senator Kelly invited me over to watch that because he says that, said that rarely happens. This is a bipartisan, comprehensive effort, but it has not been implemented.
Proceed.
So I'll share, Amanda Mativier for the record. There was some discussion about looking to other states or where success is at. We looked for success across the country when experts came together, foster youth, former foster youth, the department at the time, to find where success was. And everything continued to come back to stabilizing the workforce so that we could focus on really what the heart of this bill is, it's children. I just spent the last week in and out of the Capitol with 20 foster youth and alumni. I know a number of them came to visit with your offices. I was telling Rep. Guerra that it was humbling to almost be in two different worlds. We had a young person show up who is staying in a shelter with a trash bag, and she was so happy to stay with us the last 3 days at the hotel. And here we are walking into committees trying to explain to lawmakers what the need is. The need is about young people like her who are living in a shelter right now. And so I come into this committee and I hear numbers and stats and costs, but it's really about the state's responsibility and duty as a parent for children that they assume custody of. And a big part of that is about stabilizing the workforce. And so we looked across the country and we found success in New Jersey. New Jersey was able to overhire frontline caseworkers. So a part of that was increasing PCNs, hiring people before they left the job, because we know in child welfare across the country there's a high burnout rate. People are going to leave. So why not put the next person in that role to try to stabilize, reduce caseloads, reduce workloads so that OCS can show up and make sure that children are safe quickly, respond to resource families, foster parents quickly, and ensure that children get what they deserve and they get to go home quickly. Because with each new caseworker, the timeline that a child stays in custody goes on longer. And for children that stay in custody longer, they have more moves.
Rep. Gear.
Yeah. So one of the main provisions of House Bill 151 was to adopt the gold standard nationally and reduce caseloads. We said to an average of 13 cases per caseworker. If I had a magic wand, I would have made it 12, but there's compromise in the legislature, and I think that was a very good caseload standard. It is just very clear from the audit, excessive caseloads, you can't provide quality services to children, you can't take care of children. So it was getting excessive caseloads down first. Today, in Anchorage, the largest office in the state, caseloads are double, more than double what the law calls for. Statewide, caseloads are 50% higher than what the law calls for. 8 years since the bill passed, and that's where we are.
Slide five.
So, you know, there's continuous pressure on frontline staff and the department and the division sort of alluded to that. And I personally have spent time, I'm a professionally trained social worker. I'm also someone that has lived experience as a former foster youth. I've been a foster parent in this system. And I've also sat with young people, with families, with caseworkers after heinous cases of child abuse and neglect and even child death. And so what does that lead to? Seeing really awful things, right? And that leads to burnout. And, you know, families don't clock off, right? I was texting with a caseworker last night about an immediate need for a young person. I think we heard from the department in several committee hearings throughout this session now that the pay scale and the benefit scale is not meeting the mark for what the qualifications are to do this job. So the system moved to a system of competency-based hiring, so they reduced the qualifications for someone to come into this job. And I strongly disagree that any position, right, or any warm body is the right thing. You know, I'm also an adjunct faculty for the School of Social Work at the university. I train social workers, and what we teach them is ethics, We teach them self-care on how to manage and not burn out. We teach them how to manage cases, family systems, how to respond to trauma. And so you actually have, when you bring in people who are professionally trained to do this, reduced need for some of the intense training, right? You can fast track them and they can carry a case and they can show up and do the work in a way that's empathetic and really act in a way that they're first responders. This is also a form of public safety. But professionally trained social workers are not going to do the job for what the current wage and benefits are. For many of us, we can go into private practice. I'm in the nonprofit sector, right? Knowing that, we also need to make a living to take care of our own kids and our own families. And so the state has to be competitive in order to bring in the right people.
The crux of the problem that OCS is facing right now is at page 14 of the audit. The combination of moving from in-person training to largely virtual training, Zoom meetings, and the reduction in qualifications by workers combined led to the conclusion that what OCS is doing is woefully insufficient for the protection of children. In around 2020, OCS was facing a worker shortage 2 years after the bill passed. When the bill passed, OCS was able to hire people, qualified people, and OCS was very optimistic that this was going to work. But between 2018 and 2020, the arrival of COVID, OCS decided, with their difficulty in finding workers, they had two choices. Pay people a competitive wage to get qualified workers, or reduce the qualifications to keep the pay low. OCS chose to reduce the qualifications to keep the pay low. That was a mistake. And we're suffering from that policy decision today. Today, OCS is allowed to hire somebody with no education on foster care, with no social work degree, with no degree whatsoever. And that's fine. Do they have job experience? No. With no job experience, with no experience ever working with foster kids, with no social work experience. No experience, no degree to keep the wage low. That is what has caused the problem, and that's what we're here to ask the legislators help with. You know, one of the examples the audit mentioned is they had watered down the qualifications so much that one of the people who showed up for a job thought this was a child care job.
Ms. Mativier.
Sorry. Amanda Mativier, for the record. As we sort of explored what would work, like I mentioned, we landed on New Jersey, but also worked with a number of expert entities. And so one of those organizations was KC Family Programs. They're the largest national operating nonprofit focused on foster care. And they're going to be at the Children's Caucus tomorrow and are helping with some of the, I think, focus now on how to figure out solutions. But I'll also just reiterate to former Rep. Guerra's point that the watering down of qualifications of frontline staff, I would say, is dangerous and irresponsible. If you have someone coming in the door, again, I think regardless of how much training you can offer, who doesn't have that foundational experience on how to show up for individuals with special cause and care, you want your doctor to have, you know, college experience and lots of training before they come for their on-the-job training. You want a therapist to have the same, and a teacher, and an occupational therapist, and an officer, right? There's all these first responders or people in these safety positions or healthcare positions that we expect have an education for their foundation before they come into on-the-job training. And we absolutely have to set a standard for that when we are responding to the most vulnerable Alaskans.
Rep. Guerra.
Through the chair, thank you. One of the main things we're going to ask the legislature to do is ask OCS to honor the original part of the bill, which was 6 weeks of in-person training. We did not use the words in-person in 2018 because all training was in-person. There was no such thing as Zoom that we knew about back then. But starting in 2020, Zoom training, virtual training, has become sort of a huge part of the training system at OCS. And in other forums, OCS has said they've done this to save money on the budget. And in fact, the training budget has been cut since 2018 by roughly a quarter. The state UGF has been cut by about a quarter, and then they've lost their ability to leverage federal funds as a result. And even between last year and this year, OCS is proposing another cut to training. That's not the way to go.
the chair. How many more slides do you have?
I think Amanda Mativier, for the record, I think just one more, and then we'll let you hang on to the rest for FYI.
Well, let's see how this goes. Ms. Mativier, you were going to speak next.
Amanda Mativier, for the record, was going to add that we heard, right, about these cases being complex. Every child welfare case is complex, whether that's a one-parent, one-child case, or that's a four-parent, 13-child case. There are a number of different needs, and frontline caseworkers have to be experts in child safety, legal procedures, educational systems, behavioral health, substance use. The work in itself is complex, right? And I think the way they talked about a class study to really look at and drill into the complexity of this work. But again, I think it boils down to pay scale and benefits. I have some of my closest friends that work in this system and that have worked in this system for a long time. I was talking to a long-standing caseworker just recently, and she talked about how she had a tier 3 retirement, which people don't get anymore, and that's why she hung in, right? And in doing this job for so long. But I think that there's opportunity to incentivize this work, right? For people that are coming in and managing things in such a complex way. And again, showing up for very, very difficult circumstances that children are experiencing. But on the other side of that, we should ensure that those children experiencing this right now feel both physically and psychologically safe once they're in state care.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, one of the solutions is, and Representative Stapp touched on this, is to go to the Protective Service 3 category. Those workers make roughly $80,000 a year. They're paid for their work, right? Paying people for their work is important. And they have to be able to do complex work. So OCS has used primarily in the past Protective Service 1s and 2s. Those are lower paid employees starting at about $58,000 a year. This is a big problem. It requires a big solution. OCS's now a budget proposes to move a couple of the 1 levels into a couple of them into 2s. You need to move them to 3s. A Protective Service Specialist 3 is supposed to be able to do what's called complex casework. Foster care is complex casework. You're removing a child from their parents, and then you're doing all the things you can to repair that family back together. That's not a job for somebody who just came out of high school who's never had a full-time job. So I'm adamant that it is a PSS3 that you have to move to. You, of course, need to recruit in-state everybody that you can who would like the job. And if you can't get everybody in-state, you go to a high professional degree community, like Raleigh, North Carolina, for example. I'm just saying that. And you say, we're paying you $80,000 a year to be a social worker in the state of Alaska. And instead of saying we're in crisis, you say we have every intention of having one of the best foster care systems in the country where people will only have 13 cases on their caseload. You want to come here. That's what OCS was going to do in 2018. It's never been done. That they were going to advertise this in Alaska and across the country as the job you want as a caseworker. And if they did this at a PSS 3 at $80,000 a year, that is a good salary for a younger social worker. Or maybe a younger GAL who has no college degree but knows foster care. Right? So that's part of the solution. We can get into the technicalities of whether you do it as a budget amendment, as an intent amendment, but that's part of it.
Should we move to the next slide?
Yeah, actually, let's move to...
I would rather than to hurry you, although we do need to get to the end, if you do what I call light touch on the remaining slides and highlight the most important features. Yeah. So slide 10.
Yes. So the good thing at OCS is they have not eliminated the positions they need to reduce caseloads. They have the positions they need, and as they said, they're using the funds. The way they should use the funds that makes the most sense is this year start hiring PSS3s primarily. The $80,000 a year professional worker who can do complex social work. They have money within their budget to do this because they have so many unfilled positions. Can they hire enough to get down to a caseload of 13 per caseworker? They're not doing that in 1 year. OCS said that in 2018. It's going to take more than 1 year. It's almost like we're on day one today. It's going to take a couple of years. If they get halfway there from caseloads that are 100% and 50% higher than what they should be and reduce that excess by half this year, that will be a victory. They can do that within the current budget by hiring PSS3s. These positions, and please speak to Ledge Finance about this, these positions are normally flexible positions, so they can move a 1, 2, or 3. Sometimes they're not called flexible positions, and they need OMB's permission first. But these are largely flexible positions. OCS has a sort of small solution, which is to move a bunch of 1s into 2s. That's not going to do anything. We're not rearranging the chairs of the Titanic anymore. Or we shouldn't be. That's my recommendation to the legislature.
Okay. Slide 11.
Why don't we go to slide 12?
Good.
Slide 12. A bridge solution, right? We're probably in a 2-3 year plan if we start today to try and implement a bill that's never been implemented. Part of it is what we've discussed, real training as required by the bill, real pay for real caseworkers, which we never even knew that OCS would hire people at the level they were hiring them that didn't exist in 2018. Another bridge solution to stabilize this loss of workers. I mean, look, the PSS 1s, 2s, and 3s there today are working their hardest, and some of them plan to stay there for a career, and we should thank those people for doing that. There should be an annual retention and appreciation bonus to existing PSS 1, 2s, and 3s who are case-carrying workers. That won't be very expensive. OCS has done it before. They've said it's worked some in the past. We can find out how much it's worked. But it's logical, right? You reward people for staying and doing the hard work that they're committed to doing. You probably do that for a couple of years. You stabilize the workforce. You hire your professional service specialists, 3s, who know how to do the job and who are more likely to stay. And then I will mention this. There's something called vacancy rates, which took me forever to understand as a finance member. The worst vacancy rates are with professional service specialist 2s and 1s, 25, 30%, 32% for professional service specialist 2s. That's not working, and that's where OCS wants to put their money. The vacancy rate for a professional service specialist 3, somebody who can do complex social work, foster care social work, 10%. That's actually right in line, very closely in line, with what OMB directs the vacancy rate to be. That's the position we should be looking at. Almost all OCS's new workers should be strongly and aggressively recruited protective specialist 3s. I would mention, just because Representative Staff mentioned it, he would like to maybe replace a bunch of the 1s and 2s with 3s in the budget. And that was my first reaction, honestly. But I've been told by Legislative Finance, even if we did that, OCS doesn't have to follow that, and they can make the 3s 2s. They can make the 3s 1s. So really, this all banks on whether OCS is willing to do the work. Whether they're willing to do the work is not for me to say, but they have to be willing to do the work. So whether you do it as Representative Staff said, which is they don't have to follow it, or maybe a intent language with strong reporting requirements so the legislature can come back and look and see what they did next year, all of that is dependent on whether OCS wishes to do the things the legislature has asked them to do. In 2016, there was a periodic shortage of foster parents. There's never been an abundance, but we've had a good number of foster parents in the past. Alaskans, when they hear that there's a problem, tend to step up. When they don't hear that there's a problem, how could they step up? Well, since I left the legislature, the number of foster families has gone down, according to OCS statistics, from 1,350 to 650, roughly. They've lost roughly 600 foster families. They said today it was 400, whatever. It's 600, according to their statistics. If they say it's 400, that's fine. That's terrible. That's why children are living in OCS offices in a bunk bed. That's why children are living in a motel with a security guard patrolling the hallway. That's why children, and this is even worse, though it doesn't sound worse, that's why children are living in emergency foster homes which you can only live in for 30 days because they're not there to provide a nurturing upbringing for a child. They're temporary emergency placements, sometimes with a lot of kids. And the parent says, yeah, I'll hold the kid for 30 days, but no longer. They go there because there's no foster homes. On the 30th day, OCS, they don't violate the law, moves that child to another home, so they're not there for more than 30 days. And then on the next day, they move them back to that same emergency foster home. Three moves, before they're even at a foster home, a real foster home. OCS needs to advertise statewide to let the public in Alaska know that there is a major shortage in foster care. I can't tell you why they have not done that. We did that when I was in the legislature. OCS put out wonderful ads under former Commissioner Lawton. I don't know if this microphone is still working. Here it is. Under former Commissioner Lawton, OCS put out wonderful ads and spent money telling people we need foster parents when we did. That's logical. And we have OCS coming before you and saying sometimes they'll go to a church and see if somebody wants to become a foster parent. That's great. I mean, I did that when I was a legislator. I went to Rotary clubs and many meetings where hundreds of people would show up. And I said, we have a shortage of foster parents. I did that too. So I'm glad OCS is doing that. But that's not good. That hasn't moved the needle in 8 years. They have to take out ads. That's how all of us get elected. We take out ads or else nobody knows that we have anything to say. Right? That's the only way you get elected is by letting people know what you have to say. OCS should let people know what they have to say with ads. It's not expensive, and they've had the staff in the past to produce great ads.
Okay. Slide 14.
Boy, this is the issue of family searches. Let me try and go through this as quickly as I can.
Please.
Part of the bill recognized a national best practice, which the nonprofits, KC Family Foundation, the people who knew foster care, Amanda, who I just have to say is probably the most knowledgeable person in Alaska foster care in the state of Alaska, and I'm honored to be sitting next to her. They said foster care is fine, we have to do it, but the best thing you can do for a child who just lost their parents, who has just been taken away from their parents, is to move them into a home of a loving grandmother, a loving uncle, a loving aunt, a loving cousin who knows the child. I mean, that's true love. And that's not always the best placement, but often it is. Well, that's been the law for a long time, and OCS, even prior to the current administration, was not following that goal and that practice. I would walk up to a caseworker. We knew of caseworkers, and we said, how are your family searches going? And the caseworker said, what? They didn't know what a family search was. This is before this current OCS configuration of management, right? It predated them. We knew the work wasn't being done. In the state of Hawaii, where this work is being done, where they take it seriously, where they know the best home for a child often is a loving family member or friend of the family, they get 80% of their kids placed in loving family homes. The last statistic I saw was in the 40s here, which is what it was in 2018, a little bit better. OCS says it's in the 50s today. From hearing to hearing, the statistics have been changing. According to the audit, they had problems with OCS statistics, and I get they're very... This is an agency that's supposed to take care of children, not really keep statistics. That's a secondary job of theirs. The numbers do change, and so it's frustrating for us to chase the numbers around. The number of foster families that have disappeared, we think it's 600, maybe it's 400. In Hawaii, 80% of youth are being placed with extended family. And then you need fewer foster parents, fewer traditional foster parents. But it requires a caseworker, a qualified caseworker, not to say, hey, look, I put down on a piece of paper that I found an uncle who's not a good placement for the child. OCS is bragging that in 90% of the cases, they found somebody. That's nice. It's not an Easter egg hunt. The goal is not to find somebody. The statute says to find a placement with a relative. And we haven't been doing that. Not in the way that we should be. And that is in part due to the fact that we're being unfair to our workers by telling them, look, anybody can do this job. And then they come in and they're horrified by what the job is. And they leave. That's not the person you need looking for a family member. So we hope that the legislature can act to ask OCS strongly to follow the law. And this idea that it would cost $2 million to get a social worker supervisor to make sure the social worker has done the family search, and if not, send the social worker out to make sure they did the family search. That's the other part that OCS doesn't mention. If they haven't done it, the supervisor is supposed to send the caseworker out to do the work. OCS's response, can't do it, cost $2 million. You could do it in a folder. If they can't make the computer do it, and I don't know what kind of computer this is, you could do it in a folder. The important thing is for the supervisor to sit down with the worker to make sure the job was done. It's not the piece of paper. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Mativier, would you like to make any final comments?
Amanda Mativier, yeah, for the record, thanks. I just wanted to summarize, because I know we just kind of blew through that pretty quickly, and there's been a lot of pressure on in the media and in hearings and things like that for OCS to follow the law, and the department can't follow the law in this circumstance without resources from the legislature. And so I think there's an urgent need here, but there's another body that has to also act on this, right, to support the department to be able to follow through with caseload standards and staffing and support. And so I just wanted to reemphasize the importance of those PSS3 positions that, to the department's credit, they worked to bring these on in recent years, and it has been successful, and seasoned workers hung in to be able to get that promotion on complex cases. Bonuses, we heard, works, right, for retention for those who are carrying cases in excess. And I just wanted to highlight briefly, it was alluded to earlier, Hawaii's been talked about a few times, and there was a group of us from the department, tribes, those of us with lived experience that spent a week in Hawaii this last fall and saw some real success with what they're doing. And there are efforts that folks are working on to try to bring some of that to Alaska, because I think it's a model in some ways with adaption that really could work here, but again, may need additional financial resources.
Okay.
Thank you.
I apologize that my committee has mostly left us because they missed something. Hopefully they'll watch the video, or their staff is watching, or they're watching. But this has been meaningful. I'm willing to entertain two, not follow-ups, but two discrete questions of these two individuals. They're not getting on airplanes this minute, so you can talk to them off record. But per agreement, I wanted to invite the department to come back and offer any response. And I do want to say, maybe this is just Andy's perception, but the decorum has been outstanding, and I'm happy about that. Question?
I can't formulate a question.
Okay.
I've got
Rep. Galvin, do you have a question? Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I will have some questions that I will follow up with outside of this venue, Co-Chair, specifically around the training mechanisms. I want to know about pipeline development, how we're dealing with bringing kids out of college into this space. So lots of questions. We're not going to have time to do it here. I appreciate the presentation. I am highly frustrated, Co-Chair, right now. So I probably will not ask any additional questions because I'm so frustrated that I'm afraid that I probably would say something that would break decorum. So appreciate you bringing this item in front of us. It's a very important one. The time that we had today is not justice for what we need to be doing to cover this issue. So thank you.
I appreciate that. I want to thank Ms. Mativier, former Representative Guerra, who have been leaders. Your words were heard. And I think our subcommittee understands, pray that it does. If you'll excuse us, I'm going to invite back, if it chooses to, the department to offer any response it wishes. It's not required to the Mativier-Guerra plan, we'll call it. Commissioner.
Hi, thank you, Tracy Dombling, for the record. Thanks for the opportunity to come back. I think that probably, as you've said, you know, the committee is dwindled. So there is probably more benefit to us to respond in writing. Probably, while not the same frustrations, I also have frustrations. So not sure that I would be able to really adequately say what I want to say.
There are certainly inaccuracies. There's inaccuracies from what was shared here today versus what was just shared. That's very hard to hear. It's very hard for our staff who are also listening. So if it, you know, appeases the committee, we would just like to respond in writing.
It would. And I appreciate your indulging this format. It's not an accident that this division is, you know, is where it is, right? I think everyone, you said it beautifully, that the folks behind the desks aren't asking for these jobs because they wouldn't want to experience that sort of work. So I'm not unsympathetic to what's happening, to the degree I understand what's happening. Representative Galvin, and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Representative Chair Josephson, I really just have a very brief comment that having had a lot of experiences with OCS, even as a child, for me, I think it's important that we acknowledge that as hard as it is for staff, and it is very hard, we can only imagine what it's like for the children and the young adults. So I just think it's important that I state that. That said, it's well worth the funds to make sure that every staff member gets their due, and if that's what it takes, naturally it's still going to be difficult, but I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to thank the department. Goodness knows you people do a job that I could never do. I spent 30 years working with teenagers, and I can feel their energy. Because they've, you know, one of my nieces at 21 with a degree from college became an OCS worker in Wyoming. She did it for 3 years. And then she returned to Seattle where she worked in homeless encampments because it was an easier job to do. Because the things an OCS worker sees walking into a home, taking a baby into their arms, taking a child out of their home, and trying to problem solve a solution. And my niece is a brilliant young woman with a heart of gold, but the problems are unsolvable. And I know that your division and your staff works every day to do it. I blame leadership at a higher level. And I think previously to this configuration, you were part of the largest department in the state that we went around splitting in two. And always our concern from the policymakers was, let's not lose anything in the cracks when we divide this department. Let's not just make it smaller. Let's make sure that we're taking care of the most vulnerable Alaskans. Those are in care at API, at the Pioneer Home, in the care and custody of OCS. I happen to oversee the Department of Corrections Budget Subcommittee. I want to see the OCS workers making better pay than Department of Corrections workers, where some of my workers are making $100,000 a year in overtime. I don't want children in the same conditions as corrections, but I know that the federal regulations about the kind of care they must be provided, the wages, the ratios that we must comply with, that drives their budget way up. And we don't apparently have federal laws that mandate we care for children to those same standards. And it's heartbreaking. And I know that all of you who work in that area, you went into it because you have the heart to try and improve the circumstances for kids so that they're not in our custody in a corrections facility because they are at so much greater risk. And I'll give you billions of dollars, but we know that it doesn't just solve the problem. It's more than money. And I hope we can figure out policies to move forward with both your staff to take care of these kids who are just pulsing over here because they know that their lived experience doesn't reflect what they're hearing in so many ways. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner.
To the chair, just wanted to say one thing, and I appreciate Rep. Hannon what you just said, and I actually had listened to one of the Corrections Finance Subcommittee hearings recently. One of the members of those committees talked about something that I just want to leave us with today, and that is prevention. When we know that all over the country there's a struggle to get child welfare workers, to get corrections officers, what are we going to do to prevent those individuals from coming in a system? And that's not necessarily the state of Alaska as an agency's responsibility. That is so forward upstream to prevent people from coming into the system in general. And if we could do that, we would be able to cap caseloads at 13 and probably wouldn't need the number of staff that we have. But that also is a long-term, that's a long-term solution.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we've had a full week for sure. It's a good thing it's a weekend. I do appreciate your work and your team's work. That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Monday, March 2nd at 1:30. At that meeting, we will hear two presentations from the Department of Military Veterans Affairs. The first will be their FY27 budget overview. Then we'll hear a presentation on disaster response and financing. With that, we're going to adjourn this meeting at 4 o'clock, and we are adjourned.